Welcome back to another Weber Training Teleclass. My name is Paul Weber, and this is the third in our four-part series specifically for novice practitioners. Today's teleclass is The Basics of Outbreak Management. On behalf of my colleague, Dr. Saya Tatar, we are pleased that you have joined us today. Now, this might be, I think, one of the crowning achievements in my teleclass career, because I have been after Dr. William Jarvis to give a teleclass for several years. Many of you, probably most of you, already know his name from a lecture that you heard or an article that you read. Certainly, he is responsible for hundreds of lectures and hundreds of journal articles. In my research of this man's credentials, I discovered that there is much more to be said about him than can be possibly covered in the 2 minutes that I give myself for introduction. And I would certainly encourage you to look at the Jason and Jarvis website for more in-depth information on him. He's quite a remarkable man with quite a remarkable career. Let me just say that for 17 years, Dr. Jarvis coordinated and supervised the branch at the CDC that was responsible for conducting investigations of outbreaks in healthcare settings. He and his team investigated some 150 outbreaks, solved them all, and prevented recurrences. Dr. Jarvis presently lectures with Emory University and works with hospitals and governments around the globe. It is truly an honor to welcome him to our teleclass faculty. To present Basics of Outbreak Management from the wilds of Hilton Head, South Carolina, it is a real honor to present Dr. William Jarvis. Bill.
Thank you, Paul. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. We're going to talk about the basics of outbreak management. And as you can see from the second slide, what I want to do is review the approach to investigating outbreaks in healthcare facilities and talk about a number of different approaches, then illustrate the value of combined epidemiologic and laboratory investigations when you're doing an outbreak investigation, and then lastly, to illustrate how you, regardless of how big or small your hospital may be, can impact on patient outcomes, both locally and nationally, through outbreak investigations, oftentimes by uncovering a local or a national problem. On the next slide, we define what an epidemic or outbreak is. It's an increase in the incidence beyond the expected in a defined geographic area within a defined period of time. Also includes a significant increase in the rate of the adverse event above that noted in the past. Realize that that definition assumes a number of things. First, it assumes that you have standardized surveillance that you've been doing in that area so that you can compare the outbreak to the pre-outbreak period. It also includes using the same definitions for infection. And oftentimes we see either with the introduction of new tests, such as polymerase chain reaction, for instance, for MRSA or other pathogens, or modifications of definitions or modifications in surveillance systems that make this comparison much more difficult or challenging because the definitions have changed. On the next slide, if we take an overview of all healthcare or nosocomial infections, each year it's estimated in the United States that about 1.7 to 2 million patients acquire one of these infections annually. That number is a guesstimate and is probably an underestimate. Outbreaks, at least if we looked at the data from CDC's previously known National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System, only about 5% of the infections reported in that system occurred during epidemics or outbreaks. So they're not real frequent events, but there's some biases. First of all, most small clusters are unrecognized. If you have one or two cases of vancomycin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, of which there have been very few in the world, obviously you would recognize that. On the other hand, if it's a small cluster of two or three or five patients that have an ampicillin-resistant E. coli infection, and that ampicillin resistance in E. coli is very, very common in your institution, particularly among urinary tract infections, you never detect it. Nevertheless, outbreaks can lead to morbidity, mortality. They can consume an enormous amount of time and effort, an enormous amount of resources, and as you've seen recently in some of the lay press, can lead to enormous chaos at your institution in terms of bombardment by the press, bombardment by your patient population, and not least of all in the United States, bombardment by lawyers. If we look at the next slide, Dr. Richard Winslow, kind of the father of infection control, has said that by definition, all outbreaks are preventable. And he's somewhat differentiating epidemics or outbreaks versus endemic infections. Next slide. If we look at just the distribution of healthcare or nosocomial infections, first of all, endemic infections or sporadic. I've used the data from CNIC, the old CNIC study, the study of the efficacy of nosocomial infection control that suggested that about a third are preventable. Put a question mark there because I think more recent data show us that a much higher percentage are preventable. And these endemic infections account for the majority of healthcare-associated infections. In contrast, outbreaks or epidemics are, as I mentioned, a significant increase from this endemic baseline rate. It's the minority of infections, but theoretically, at least, all of them should be preventable. On the next slide, as I mentioned, there's a number of implicit assumptions with this definition of outbreak and the ability to detect an outbreak, that the case definition has not changed, that the methods for diagnosing the disease or identifying the organism have not changed, and that case-finding methods have not changed. And for that reason, rather than doing benchmarking as has been done in the past, I think it's much more valuable to compare your rate to your own rate over time rather than comparing to my rate or somebody else's rate when you don't know that the case definitions or the methods for diagnosis or the case finding methods are the same. Next slide. Then you also have the issue of pseudo-outbreaks or pseudo-epidemics. These can be either real clusters of false infections or false clusters of real infections. One of the first papers describing pseudo-outbreaks on the next slide by Weinstein and Stamm, published in Lancet in 1977, looked at CDC data between 1956 and 1975 and found that 20 of 181, or 11% of the outbreaks investigated, were consistent with pseudo-outbreaks. 55% resulted from errors of collecting, handling, or processing specimens. 30% resulted from surveillance artifacts, and 15% for errors of clinical diagnosis. If we look more recently, I think laboratory error, particularly cross-contamination in the laboratory, probably accounts for a much higher percentage now when we use many automated systems, which in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s were not the case. On the next slide are shown the goals of any outbreak investigation. They're pretty simple. Identify the etiologic agent or agents. Identify the reservoir or reservoirs. Identify the mode of transmission. Eliminate the reservoir or reservoirs and transmission. And then prevent future outbreaks. Next slide. There are many approaches to an outbreak investigation, but I've divided them up into kind of two. The first I'll call quick and dirty, and the second is a detailed epidemiologic and laboratory investigation. The reason I've done this is that I think most infection control professionals in your individual institutions most often do number one, quick and dirty, whereas the CDC, perhaps the Canadian Ministry of Health, are more likely to do the detailed epidemiologic and laboratory investigation for a simple reason, that they have personnel and resources that can dedicate their time, whether it be 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 5 weeks, to focusing on nothing but doing an outbreak investigation, whereas all of you have a few other jobs to do, and your hospital administrator probably would not be very receptive to you saying, well, I'm going to take a time out and do an outbreak investigation for the next 5 weeks, and I won't be doing anything else. So as a result, the quick and dirty approach is used very, very commonly. On the next slide is described a little bit about the quick and dirty outbreak investigation. First of all, it's the quickest. It's the least expensive. And the approach often takes either all of these or some of these, including a case definition, very quick one of case ascertainment, developing a line listing to look for common exposures, and then introducing control measures and hoping that the outbreak is terminated and you can go on with your life doing something else. On the next slide, I show the detailed outbreak investigation. It's personnel and resource intensive. It combines both epidemiology and laboratory investigation. Excuse me, there's a typo there. That should be more expensive. And the approach takes the first few steps that you used in the quick and dirty of case definition, case ascertainment, line listing, and maybe even epidemic curve, but then it deviates. In a comparative study, whether that be a case control or a cohort study or a personnel study is done, that might lead to laboratory studies, including inanimate or animate cultures or isolate comparison using molecular or other types of techniques. You might do observational studies. Then you might introduce control measures. And you need to always do post-outbreak surveillance, no matter if it's the detailed or the quick and dirty, to document that you really did identify the reservoir and the mode of transmission and have terminated the outbreak. On the next slide is shown the importance of the microbiology laboratory. It's a very important source for case finding if you know the etiologic agent. Identity of the organism as completely as possible, whether that's genus and species or even going to epidemiologic typing, can be very, very helpful. And it's important as soon as you recognize that a potential outbreak might be occurring to communicate with the director of the laboratory and request that they save all the potential specimens or isolates. This doesn't mean they need to keep hundreds or thousands of isolates and keep them for months or years, but at least keep those isolates until you know you have or don't have an outbreak. If you don't have an outbreak, then they can throw them out. If you do, then you may be able to do additional testing on them. Why is this important? Well, when I was at CDC, I had a number of calls saying that they had identified the first isolate of vancomycin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. I asked them for their isolate so we could confirm them, and they'd say, oh, the lab had thrown them out. Well, it's hard to believe the lab would throw out an isolate of something that's never happened before, but maybe that happens. But in any event, it's important very early on when you first suspect that there's an outbreak occurring to contact a laboratory and ensure that those isolates are kept. They can help you determine whether it's a common source or non-common source outbreak. So let's walk through these steps. The case definition on the next slide. It's a description of the case as it changes as new data are accumulated. And it always includes time, place, and person. An example is who did it or who. What happened, when did it happen, and where did it happen? An example, for instance, of an SSI outbreak might be pus at the operative site in a patient in this SICU at Hospital A from May 1st to 10th, 2005, with wound or blood cultures positive for MRSA that has a particular pulse field gel electrophoresis or PFGE pattern. So this includes the time, the place, and the person. And every case definition should include all of those variables. Once you suspect you have an outbreak and you have a tentative case definition, you may want to do a literature review. Find out what is the usual reservoir for this organism. What is the usual mode of transmission? Has it ever been reported to cause outbreaks? And what factors were important in those outbreaks? Was it IV lines, contaminated products or food items, contaminated respiratory therapy equipment, breaks in sterile technique, etc. For a very unusual organism that's never been seen before, obviously the literature review won't take very long. But for many other clusters that occur, the literature review can be very helpful to identify all of these factors, and particularly if you're doing a quick and dirty investigation, help you more readily and rapidly reach conclusions as to what kind of control measures should be introduced. On the next slide, you want to define the extent of the problem. You can do these using many, many, many data sources. Hopefully the most useful will be your surveillance system. Also useful, especially if it's a pathogen-specific case definition, is a microbiology lab where they can look back over time to see how common that pathogen is at particular sites. If the outbreak involves healthcare workers, looking at employee health records, for instance, did they have diarrhea, respiratory tract disease, has it increased recently? You may want to look to other healthcare facilities in the region to see whether they are having the same problem that you're having. Then city, county, state, provincial, or federal health agencies may be important to contact to see if this is more widespread. And then depending upon your hospital, and some hospitals contract out their laboratory work, you may need to try to call those reference laboratories to see, first of all, have they noticed an increase in your organism? And secondly, to reinforce again, trying to keep those isolates. Once you have those data, as shown on the next slide, you want to calculate your attack rate. It can be done a number of ways, and you may not do it just one. It could be the number of patients affected divided by the number of patients at risk. For instance, the number of patients with a bloodstream infection in your intensive care unit over the last month divided by the number of patients in that unit or the number of patients with central venous catheters in that unit during that same time period. Or you might want to divide the number of infections, because one patient may have more than one, divided by the number of patients at risk. Or last, the number of adverse outcomes divided by the number of patients at risk. But in calculating the attack rate, you want to calculate it for your purported epidemic period and compare it with a previous period of time. On the next slide is define the epidemic period. It's the time from the onset of the first case to the cases you're currently under investigating. And as additional cases occur, that time continues to evolve. In contrast, as shown on the next slide, the pre-epidemic period is somewhat arbitrarily defined. It's a period of time that is long enough to provide sufficient cases of a low-frequency event. It's usually at least 6 months of data, but it may be more than 6 months, particularly if you're dealing with an organism that causes seasonal disease. For instance, if you're evaluating a respiratory syncytial virus or an influenza virus outbreak, then obviously looking at the past 6 months, which would include only the summertime, would not be a very good idea. You need to at least go back 12 months so you cover and include the same time period where the higher attack rate might occur during the winter. Similarly for diarrheal diseases that occur primarily in the summertime. Rather than just comparing them with the wintertime, you want to go back at least 12 months. And in some cases, the pre-epidemic period might even be 2 years. On the next slide, we've defined what an epidemic curve is. It's a graphic display of the outbreak with time, and you can do many epidemic curves, okay, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, and you place that on the x-axis and the number of persons meeting the case definition on the y-axis. And you graph both the pre-epidemic and the epidemic periods. The reason you draft such a curve is to give you an idea of the primary mode of transmission. Realizing that the longer the outbreak has been going, the more likely you are to potentially have more than one mode of transmission. For instance, you might have an outbreak of gastroenteritis in a long-term care facility, and that might initially be associated with a foodborne contaminant, in which case you would have a point source and an immediate rise in a large number of cases. And with a point source outbreak, you usually have very low levels, if any, disease, and then a peak to high disease, and then a very quick dropping to no disease. In contrast, if this outbreak had been going on for a longer period of time, you might have other residents in the long-term care facility or even healthcare workers who have contact with the primary cases and then become secondary cases, in which case you have started with a point source and moved to person-to-person transmission. And that is why investigating outbreaks early on is so useful because it oftentimes is just one mode of transmission, whereas if it goes on and lingers for a while, you may have multiple modes of transmission. On the next slide is the line listing, which really is a search for risk factors. And you can include a large number of variables. Usually you include admission date, infection date, so you can see how long was the patient in the facility before they developed their infection, demographic data, age, gender, to look to see if it's just old patients, just young patients, just males, underlying diseases, is this a disease that's only occurring in highly immunocompromised patients, pre-infection exposures, what service were they on, what ward, what unit, if possible, what bed in the room, operating room, what room were they in when they had their surgical procedure, diagnostic test, therapeutic interventions, and personnel. And as you describe these linearly for each patient, you can then look down the columns and see what looks common. And that helps you focus your investigation, whether it be a quick and dirty, in which case you identify very quickly that all patients had CVCs, all of them were in your medical intensive care unit, and all of them received total parenteral nutrition. Therefore, you can focus your prevention efforts on those areas. Next slide shows that we then take these data from your epidemic curve, your line listing, the literature review, and you form a hypothesis. What is your best guess at the reservoir and the mode of transmission? As shown on the next slide, you then take that hypothesis, and if you're doing it quick and dirty, you introduce your control measures and see if it works. And if you're doing the more detailed investigation, you then move on to the comparative study. This would include either doing a case control or a cohort study. There are a number of factors that determine which of these types of comparative studies that you are likely to do. The first is the number of cases. For a low-frequency event, as are most healthcare-associated infections, a case control study is easier to do because you have a small number of cases over either a short or long period of time. In contrast, if it's a large number of patients, you may still want to do a case control study because you may not want to review 400 charts. The duration of the outbreak. The shorter the duration of the outbreak, the more likely you are to do a cohort study where you take all patients rather than a case control study. The rarity of the adverse event. You increase your power by doing a case control study and ease of collecting the data, and then how much time you have. If you want to spend the next year doing it, you could do a cohort study of an outbreak that's occurred for 6 months in your medical intensive care unit because it's going to take you that long to review all of the records. Now let's look at using a case control study as shown on the next slide. In this type of comparative study, you compare the cases to a group of controls. The proportion in each group exposed to various risk factors are then compared. So you take all patients in your, you take your cases, you randomly select a number of controls from your medical intensive care unit, and then you look at what proportion of your cases had exposure to surgery, what proportion had blood transfusion, what proportion had total parenteral nutrition, and you compare the proportions in the cases from the control group. Were the case patients exposed to the risk factor that controls were or not? And then you look at an association through using either a chi-square or Fisher's exact test to see whether there's statistically significant difference. You need to keep in mind that whether you use a case control or a cohort study, you have to consider the power of the study. For instance, if you have a cluster of 3 or maybe even 5 cases of a particular disease, even if you select 2 or 3 or 4 controls, even if there is a risk factor that was responsible for this in our exposure, you may not find a statistically significant difference. On the next slide is a very important issue, selecting the control group. You want to choose patients from an appropriate subpopulation. For example, if you're doing a study in a neonatal intensive care unit and all of the case patients are less than 1,500 grams and you decide to randomly select controls from the non-case group, more likely than not, the majority of them are going to be more than 1,500 grams, and you'll have a study that has a very important bias introduced from the very beginning. Second is, how many controls do you select? 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1? Most pick somewhere between 2 to 4, if there are fewer than 10 cases. And the reason is that if you look at this statistically, after you reach about 3, you gain a little bit of power by going to 4, but you don't gain that much power by going to 5 or 6 or 7 or 10. And for that reason, I would caution you when you're looking at the literature. And if you see a case control study where they select 10 controls for each case, you should be very suspicious of that study, because more likely than not, they've chosen 10 controls to try to get something to reach statistical significance. And it may just be a function of the design rather than true risk factor. My suggestion is initially don't match for anything. You can control for potential confounding variables such as age, gender, by either doing multivariate or stratified analysis. Remember that stringent matching obscures the risk factor. If you match by gender, then by definition, gender will not be a significant risk factor when you compare your cases to controls. You've matched for it. Also, you can't analyze matched variables using certain type of analyses. You have to do more complicated types of analyses. On the next slide are some clues that are important in investigating an outbreak. The first is if you have multiple organisms causing infection at a single site or associated with an invasive procedure, it strongly suggests that the problem is related to aseptic technique or person-to-person transmission and not a clonal outbreak. Second is a single organism, particularly if it's clonal, suggests a common source. And if you find that, there's almost always an answer. As I mentioned before, the epidemic curve may suggest the mode of transmission. If you go from none to a peak of a large number of cases, and then very quickly back to baseline none, more likely than not, you have a common source. On the other hand, if you have one case, and then the next day or week, two cases, and then one case, and then three cases, and then one case, and then four cases. More likely than not, this is person-to-person transmission. Last, an unusual organism may be a clue to the problem. For instance, Enterobacter cloacae, Enterobacter agglomerans have been associated with contaminated IV fluids. Salmonella munchen has been associated with contaminated platelets. So some organisms seem to be associated with certain types of problems. On the next slide, we talk about epidemiologic typing. It's looking for the epidemiologic relatedness of isolates. Are all of the isolates from cases derived from a single clone, in which case strongly suggests a common source? Do they share characteristics that differ them from those of epidemiologically unrelated isolates? Are isolates from more than one patient or from patients in the environment the same, or are they different? But regardless of the answer to any of these, the laboratory results don't replace the epidemiologic analyses. If you have to believe one or the other, believe the epidemiologic analysis. In one outbreak we did at CDC, there was an outbreak of group A streptococcal infections at a hospital. An epidemiologic investigation was done, both case control and cohort studies were done, and suggested one individual was involved as a potential source. Cultures of that individual were done, and they were negative. The officer was sent back to the site, did two more epidemiologic investigations, which again suggested this one individual was responsible. Cultures again were negative. Do you discard the epidemiologic results? No. Another study was done confirming that this individual was responsible, and then cultures again were done even more extensively, And what happened was there was a little small area behind this individual's ear where there was atopic dermatitis that was culture positive. So the epidemiologic results were always correct. The laboratory result was not, because you just may not have identified the right place to culture the individual. So the epidemiologic results should always take precedence over the laboratory results. On the next slide, we talk a little bit about some of the characteristics of epidemiologic typing. First of all, typability is the ability to obtain an unambiguous positive result for each isolate analyzed. Reproducibility is the ability to give the same result each time a strain is tested. And then discriminatory power is the ability to differentiate among unrelated strains. For any typing system, you want to have typability, reproducibility, and discriminatory power. If your test has no discriminatory power and you can't really differentiate isolates from one from the other, then it's of no use to you. If it's not reproducible, where one time you get one result and another time you get another result, that's not useful either. And if you have a system that only types 20% of the isolates of that genus, unless all of the infections occur with that 20%, again, it's not a very useful type of test. On the next slide, we talk about the hierarchical approach to typing. Many want to start with pulse field gel electrophoresis or other genotyping methods, but start with a simple, inexpensive, and readily available test. Do you have genus and species? What's the antibiogram look like? Are there other biochemicals that give you some indication of this being the same or different? It may even be colony morphology. In one of the outbreak investigations that I did early in my career, the microbiologist at a relatively small hospital realized that there were two different strains of Klebsiella pneumonia just by looking at the culture plate and seeing they had colony morphologies that were different. Many, many weeks later, it was documented at CDC that, in fact, this individual was right. So a very simple test using your eyeballs gave as good a result as doing genotyping. Do the more expensive, more difficult, and less readily available test only if their clinical, epidemiologic, and microbiological data indicating that they really are necessary. On the next slide are shown some of the phenotypic techniques. I've already mentioned colony morphology, biotyping, serotyping, phage typing, immunoblotting, antimicrobial susceptibility testing, and multilocus enzyme electrophoresis. Many of these tests are not quite as good as genetic typing, but they can provide you some useful information. And in some cases, maybe all you need. If we look at some of the characteristics as shown on the next slide of phenotypic typing, you can see the typing system, the proportion of strains that are typable using that system, the reproducibility and discriminatory power. Just look at those columns. You can see that the proportion that are typable for biotyping, antibiogram, immunoblotting, and multilocus enzyme electrophoresis, you can type virtually any isolate. In contrast, serotyping and phage typing, many are most, but not all. Things go downhill when we move to the right to reproducibility. Only one, the multilocus enzyme electrophoresis, is excellent. Biotyping is poor. Phage typing, when you can even do it, is only fair. None of the rest are excellent. And we go downhill even further when we move to discriminatory power. Biotyping and antibiogram are poor. Serotyping and phage typing are dependable upon the isolate, specific genus, how many serotypes or phage types are available. And only immunoblotting, or MLE, are good. So as shown on the next slide, we move to molecular techniques. And there are a wide variety of techniques, including cellular fatty acid analysis, pyrolysis mass spectrophotometry, whole cell polypeptide analysis, plasmid pattern analysis, ribotyping, pulse field gel electrophoresis, or polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. And it's really the last two, or maybe three, that are most commonly used, with pulse field gel electrophoresis being the most commonly used. On the next slide, I show the characteristics of these typing techniques. As you can see, plasmid analysis can type most. All the others can type all. Reproducibility is only fair for plasmid analysis, variable for REA, but excellent for ribotyping, pulse field, or PCR. Discriminatory power is excellent for pulse field. Unknown is there for PCR, and that's primarily because PCR just hasn't been applied to as large a group of genus and species as pulse field. But it appears as if both pulse field gel electrophoresis and PCR will both be excellent in terms of reproducibility and in discriminatory power. On the next slide is shown just a schematic of what is involved with pulse field gel electrophoresis. You take the bacterial chromosome and you apply a number of enzymes, one or more enzymes. In this case, the little lines that you see on the circular chromosome are where the enzyme would cut the organism, its DNA. You then place it in wells, as you can see, different isolates in wells 1 through 6, and then you direct an electric current, either a unidirectional or more than one direction, and it separates the segments of the chromosome by size, with the larger pieces of chromosome being closer to where you first put them in, and the smaller pieces running further down the gel. As you can see on the next slide is just a visual example of this. If you use multidirectional electrocurrent, the organisms move back and forth across and you get even better discrimination. As shown on the next slide, you move from one where you have direction of the current one direction, two to another direction, moving the pieces in a differential fashion. So on the next slide are some of the advantages of pulse field gel electrophoresis. First, it's less hands-on time. You prepare the specimen, you put it in the well, turn on the electricity, and it works on its own. Virtually all organisms should be typable. There's less nonspecific DNA shearing. There are fewer bands for some of the types, like ribotyping. Per pattern, as a result, it's easier to read, and this is somewhat dependent upon what enzyme you select. It does not require probes, and it can be extended to probes if you want to add PCR to it, and it has more discriminatory power than ribotyping. What are some of the disadvantages? Well, you have high startup costs. The method of interpretation is not standardized, and it's primarily visual. You may need two gels to visualize both the upper and lower molecular weight organisms, because if you limit your electrical current, you may separate your small bands or lower molecular weight bands, but the larger bands never even leave the well. On the other hand, if you provide enough current or long enough time to move the longer bands into the gel, your small bands may be running off the other end of the gel. So you may need two gels to differentiate each of those classes. And then last, it takes longer than PCR. Next is shown PCR, where you take the original DNA, you denature and then synthesize, you add your primers, new DNA is developed. On the next slide, you have a number of different approaches to PCR. You have arbitrary primed or AP-PCR, randomly amplified polymorphic DNA or RAPIDs, specific sequence polymorphisms, and polymerase chain reaction ribotyping. On the next slide are some of the advantages of PCR. First of all, it's rapid. It's relatively inexpensive. It can be virtually universally applied to different organisms. And it can type some organisms that the other typing mechanisms may not be very good at. For instance, if the organism grows slowly or doesn't grow at all. It works even if the organism is non-viable. The other techniques will not. It can be done in tissues. The other techniques cannot. And it can be done on organisms that are hazardous to grow where you don't really want to grow them up. So there are a number of major advantages to PCR, particularly if the organism is slow growing, doesn't grow, or is hazardous. On the next slide are some of the advantages of PCR. First, you can use it on sheared or single-stranded DNA, which the other techniques you can't do. You can use nanogram amounts, very small amounts, which the other techniques require more. You can get good discrimination from most organisms. You can use endonucleases if you want, as we mentioned earlier, to increase the discrimination. And the equipment or method can be used for diagnostic tests, which are readily available in the laboratory, as well as for typing. So it's multi-use. On the next slide are some of the disadvantages. Well, first, it amplifies any contaminating DNA. So if you're not very careful in what you've done and you've contaminated it, it will amplify that as well. It's sensitive to a variety of conditions, including the concentration of magnesium, the temperature. So standardizing the technique is very important. Again, the method for interpretation is not standardized. It may be difficult to identify good primers. Each primer requires a separate gel. And then, as mentioned before, there are limited data in that the technique has not been applied to a wide variety of organisms and a wide variety of species within genus. On the next slide, we compare the different typing methods, plasmid analysis, pulse field gel electrophoresis, and PCR, and just give some guesstimates of time and cost. In terms of supplies, plasmid analysis and PCR are less expensive than pulse field because of that initial investment of equipment. Hands-on time, PCR is the fastest. Pulse field and plasmid analysis are about the same. Overall time, PCR is the fastest, plasmid analysis the second, pulse field is last. And then equipment costs, least expensive is plasmid analysis, the most expensive is pulse field electrophoresis. So you need to take into consideration the supplies for running it, the initial equipment cost, how long it takes to get the answer, and how much hands-on time it takes when you decide what method you want to introduce into your laboratory. On the next slide is one hospital's approach. The microbiology laboratory is asked to save all isolates from normally sterile body sites and all nosocomial infections, at least until the infection control department has said they no longer need them. They process surveillance cultures and culture the environment as necessary, and they do ribotyping via a riboprinter and our pulse field to determine whether isolates are the same or not. So now that we've gone through the schematic of the detailed investigation, let's move to the next slide and walk through an actual investigation that we did at CDC to show that what I'm telling you you should do is what we actually applied and how well it works. This is an outbreak investigation of Serratia marcescens bloodstream infections in a surgical intensive care unit. On the next slide is the background. Between July and September of 1998, the hospital experienced 9 episodes of Serratia marcescens bloodstream infections in their surgical intensive care unit. They had not seen very many Serratia marcescens bloodstream infections, so this was pretty easily detected and pretty rapidly detected. Between September 98 and February 99, extensive culturing was done. Now, I hope you noticed that I didn't mention extensive culturing or culturing the environment as one of the first things to do. And yet, often people do that. Realize that it's kind of like, well, actually a pig finding a mushroom is probably more successful. That culturing the environment often, if not most of the time, fails to identify the source unless it's preceded by an epidemiologic investigation that suggests this particular source is involved. By March of 1999, an additional 10 cases had occurred despite the introduction of a number of control measures, and CDC was requested to assist in an investigation. As background is shown on the next slide, this hospital is about a 500-bed tertiary care center with a trauma center. The surgical intensive care unit is geographically separate from other wards and ICUs, and the SICU has 3 different stations. 150 to 200 patients are admitted per month. Most common admission is post-cardiac bypass, and about 12% of the patients are admitted for trauma. On the next slide, if you look at the background information, and an excellent review by Victor Yu, published in New England Journal in 1979, Serratia marcescens is a gram-negative bacillus. It's found in water in the environment, is not a part of the normal human flora. It's a rare but serious cause of healthcare-associated infections, usually associated with urinary tract infections, or wounds, and even more rarely with bloodstream infections, and hospital outbreaks have been associated with a wide variety of sources. In fact, on the next slide is shown many of the outbreaks associated with pressure transducers in two different outbreaks, with flexible bronchoscopes in another, with extrinsically contaminated heparinized saline solution, cleaning solutions or soaps that are known not to be marketed as sterile, also been associated with employees' hands or nails, and has also been associated with a decreased nurse-to-patient ratio. So the first step, as shown on the next slide, is to determine whether this is really an outbreak or not. So two different analyses were done. First was a review of the microbiology data for Serratia species blood cultures positive at that hospital. When that was done, you can see the surgical intensive care unit had 6.2 isolates per 1,000 patient days, compared with a hospital non-SICU, 0.06. So certainly, this was highly statistically significant. There was a higher rate of Serratia in the SICU than everywhere else in the hospital. Well, maybe they just had Serratia infections in the ICU all the time. So next was compare the rate over time in the SICU. And as you can see, we went back for a year. And during the epidemic period, there were 8 isolates per 1,000 central line days, because we had line days and all the patients had lines, compared to 0.13 isolates per 1,000 central line days in the pre-epidemic period, documenting that this was an outbreak in the hospital that was located in the SICU, and this SICU, the rate was much higher than it had previously been. Next was the case definition. Pretty easy. SICU patient at this hospital with Serratia marcescens bloodstream infection during the epidemic period identified as from the first case to the time of the investigation. On the next slide is illustrated the epidemic curve. And as you can see, except for January of 1997, where there was one isolate, and then went for over a year and a half with none, and then this cluster between July 98 and April of 99. This looks like a common source outbreak. On the next slide were some of the case characteristics that were somewhat unusual, suggested that something odd might be going on. First of all, 8 or 31% of the patients had polymicrobial bacteremia. And it wasn't just Serratia, but it was with Enterobacter species in 27% of the cases. Well, if you go to your laboratory and you ask them about polymicrobial bacteremia, except for abdominal catastrophes, such polymicrobial bacteremia is pretty unusual. And in the majority of the cases, it will be coagulase negative staphylococci and something else, which may well be a contaminant. So two different gram-negative organisms in the absence of abdominal catastrophe is very unusual. Second was these patients had persistent bacteremia in 50% of the cases, had multiple blood cultures positive for both of these organisms over multiple days. And then very odd was the fact that 69% of them had positive blood cultures at the time they were on antibiotics, even when the antibiotic was one that should have killed this organism. So these characteristics were very unusual and suggested that something very odd was going on here. Next was to assess the potential that this was patient-to-patient transmission, which seemed pretty unlikely. But to do that, we did a culture survey of all patients in the ICU on one day, looked at tracheal and urine specimens that had been obtained within one day. And of the 24 patients, only one had a tracheal Serratia culture positive. So it was highly unlikely that this was coming from a specific patient source and going patient to patient. Also, a review of microbiology data for clinical isolates ratio showed there were very few cultures that were positive for other sites. Next was an environment. Could it be environmental contamination? Well, I already told you that a large variety of environmental cultures were done and they were negative. But also cases where in three different nursing stations and 10 different patient single patient rooms, highly suggestive that this was not environmental contamination. So the next step was to do a comparative study, and this included a case control study. We've talked about the epidemic period, we've talked about the case patients, so control patients were randomly selected SICU patients who had been in the ICU for more than 48 hours because that was the minimum stay for a case patient to develop BSI. And these controls could not have a gram-negative bloodstream infection with any other organism, even other than Serratia. A large variety of factors were examined, as shown on the next page. In fact, since we had no idea what was going on, a 9-page questionnaire was done. Non-significant was gender, age, surgical procedure, intubation or mechanical ventilation, respiratory care, severity of illness on admission, or mortality, although if definite and probable cases were included, mortality was significant. On the next slide is shown the factors that were significant. Trauma, transfusion, and bronchoscopy were all statistically significant. But I'd like to look at attributable risk. So you could explain 62% of the cases had trauma. What about the other 38%? Well, 100% got transfusion, but 80% of the controls got transfusions as well. And if you want bronchoscopy to be the risk factor, only 42% had bronchoscopy, so what about the other 58% of cases? So it did not look like these were true risk factors, but rather were confounders associated with underlying disease and severity of illness. The other thing that was significant, shown on the next slide, was the fentanyl exposures. If you receive fentanyl in the SICU, 96% of cases versus 45% of controls place you at 31% higher odds. Continuous infusion was even greater odds, 42%. Cases had more days of exposure and more or larger volumes of exposure. And all of these were highly statistically significant. Well, we looked, as shown on the next slide, at fentanyl, which is an analgesic and sedative. It's an opiate and narcotic, 80 times more potent than morphine. It was widely used throughout that hospital, in the OR, SICU, MICU, and was given by a variety of routes, including continuous infusion, intravenous bolus, and epidural infusion. So next was tracking the fentanyl. Where did this contamination come from? We thought about intrinsic contamination, but contacted the Food and Drug Administration. There have been no reports from any other hospital, which seemed to make it very unlikely. So more likely was extrinsic contamination after manufacture. As shown on the next slide, this is taking the ampule out of the Pyxis in the SICU. The fentanyl was not manipulated at any time from the time the truck delivered it to the hospital until it got to the SICU pharmacy. So there was no opportunity for extrinsic contamination outside of the SICU. Next is a picture of an infusion bag. One of the things we asked to do was any patient that had signs and symptoms during the time of the investigation immediately quarantine the IV fluids and bags and culture them. And this was the case in two different patients. On the next slide is shown the laboratory cultures. We looked at ampules outside the SICU. Not surprisingly, they were negative. Ampules inside the ICU that had not been opened yet, they also were negative. Equipment infusion bag, except for the one I just showed you, they were negative. The infusions that I just showed you were positive, indeed positive for both organisms. So it seemed as if intrinsic contamination outside the SICU or at the time of manufacture or extrinsic contamination outside the ICU was highly unlikely. On the next slide, we did pulse field gel electrophoresis of these isolates, and 24 of the 25 case patient isolates were identical. And in fact, all 7 Enterobacter isolates were identical as well. We also inoculated these organisms in fentanyl and in the laboratory showed that they would survive and even grow. So we had a point source outbreak with clonal strains of Serratia and Enterobacter. Next is shown the pulse field gel electrophoresis pattern for the Serratia isolates, and you can see 1 through 8 with 7A and 8 and B, 7 and 8 being from the patient, A and B being from the fentanyl infusions taken from those patients, and you can see there's a 1-band difference and this would be considered the same. The next slide shows Enterobacter cloacae, and they are identical all across the board. So next is going where you don't want to go because it's a Pandora's box. Patient care, as you can imagine, was provided by many healthcare workers. So we reviewed the medical records for exposure to these healthcare workers, more than 100 SICU nurses, 80 physicians, and 50 respiratory therapists, and you can imagine the fun trying to read their signatures and identify their contacts. On the next slide is shown those that were statistically associated with cases were limited to respiratory therapy. Respiratory therapists number 3, 11, 13, 16, and 18, with 18 having the highest kind of attributable rate of 88% and the highest odds ratio of 13.1. On the next slide is shown the fact that respiratory therapists usually don't work alone. And in fact, there was many opportunities for overlap. And if we looked at RT18 working with or without anyone else, you can see that in the far left corner, RT18 cared for 8 patients alone, RT3 for 3 alone, and RT18 and 3 for 15 together. And similarly for all of the rest. In each case, RT18 cared for more patients alone than the other respiratory therapist did alone. Interestingly, the implicated healthcare worker, this RT18, was an SICU supervisor, and it was associated with most of the cases, 23 of the 26, we could document exposure. Interestingly, before the on-site investigation, this individual had been witnessed tampering with a fentanyl infusion of a case patient, and as happens often, a incident report was made and was filed. At that point, we requested, as shown on the next slide, that RT18 be removed, asked for consent to search his locker, culture hands and anticubital fossa, and then test for drugs. On the next slide is shown the multivariate analysis that shows that when we did that, continuous infusion of fentanyl remained significant with a 44 times higher rate of disease. RT3 and RT18 both remained statistically significant, with RT3 having a higher odds ratio and RT18 having a higher p-value. Hand cultures, as shown on the next slide, were done by the HandiWipe method, and hand and anticubital fossa cultures were both negative. We then asked this epidemiologically implicated healthcare worker to provide a hair sample, which was sent to a forensic laboratory and tested positive for fentanyl, documenting, much to his disagreement, chronic fentanyl use. On the next slide is the epidemic curve after the removal of RT18. Remember, RT3, that was still significant in multivariate analysis, continued to work, and no further cases occurred. So the mystery is solved by epidemiology and laboratory. It's RT18 in the SICU with continuous fentanyl infusion. So the case closed? Well, almost. You'd still like to know, as shown on the next slide, how fentanyl became contaminated. Did it become contaminated during manipulation by the implicated healthcare worker's hands? And since he was forewarned about the culturing, he was able to scrub his hands and remove that colonization? Was he reusing a device or a needle? Or was he using a common source of liquid for replacement of the fentanyl so the fentanyl bag would not look as if it had been manipulated? Unfortunately, this individual was not cooperative, and we were unable to identify what the mode or modes of transmission or contamination of the fentanyl actually were. However, laboratory cultures, as shown on the next slide, of sinks and showers in the hospital or bottles of water that might have been used were all negative for serratia. Now, you might be thinking this is very odd and doesn't apply to me. Well, if we look on the next slide, the public health scope, national estimates are that about 4.2% of hospital workers admit to present illicit drug use. Almost 9% of them acknowledge past use. And in a 1983 survey, 214, or 74%, of 289 U.S. anesthesiology residency training programs reported at least one drug abuse or dependence episode. Not surprisingly, meperidine and fentanyl were the most common agents reported. So certainly abuse of drugs is not an unusual occurrence in a hospital setting. And unknowing to most of us, an infection control serves as a potential route for contamination and infection in our patients. So in summary, this is an outbreak of serratia marcescens bloodstream infections in SICU patients at Hospital A associated with contamination of fentanyl. Epidemiology, a witnessed event, and drug testing suggest extrinsic contamination by a single healthcare worker. Use of epidemiology and laboratory methods aided in termination of the outbreak. The outbreak had complicating factors I didn't mention to you, but a number of these patients died. As shown on the next slide, we sent a report to the hospital administration. RT18 was permanently relieved of his duties. The hospital presented the findings to the district attorney's office, but they said the case would not be pursued because of insufficient evidence. I'm not sure what more evidence they needed. And obviously, state health department officials were informed as well. So in summary, on the next slide, an outbreak occurring at your facility may be an indicator of a nationwide outbreak. Combined laboratory and epidemiologic investigation can identify the source of the outbreak, and investigation-based prevention interventions can terminate the outbreak. Thank you very much. Now I'll turn it back to Paul.
Dr. Jarvis, thank you very much. I'm amazed at the process that is involved in investigating an outbreak. You can certainly see how that would add to the cost of infection control in a hospital. Thank you again to all of you for joining us on this teleclass. A special thanks to Dr. Jarvis for putting these slides together and presenting them in a very timely and a really very fascinating way. Thank you very much for that. Until we meet again, everyone, goodbye.